Hyperion to a satyr.
Welcome to the 9th episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, and having just finished my scene-by-scene deep dive look at Act 1 through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations, today we're taking a look back at the act, but we'll also cover an adaptation we haven't touched yet, 1994's The Lion King. And I'm not using the royal we, I do have a guest. Everyone, please welcome, dear readers, Stella to the show. Hi, Stella.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm interested to, or excited, I guess I should say, to talk about such an uplifting play by Shakespeare.
It is something of a downer. Well, no, it's got comedy. I believe it has comedy. But thank you for pushing me into this. Because, dear reader, it was always the first thing I listened to when it came out that day.
Ooh. I appreciate that.
I wouldn't call myself a Jane Eyre fan, necessarily. I've seen a couple adaptations, and I've never really read the book. You know, I have a friend who was really into it and had occasion to talk about it on other shows. You know, I felt compelled to at least listen to the first one, but it was pretty addictive, I must say. And then it just got me thinking, well, I've got all of this stuff about Hamlet in me that I could do a similar show, but I think I've used a different formula, at least. Thank you. You're the one that really, I don't know, set the tone that it could be done on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Yeah, it's always the first person kind of breaking through the mold of what the shows were or are on that network. I think it was going to be the hardest. But now I think it seems like everyone on the board, as I like to call it, and even fans were happy that this sort of thing existed, that it was more literature based. And I don't know, like, how your numbers are. I kind of stopped looking at mine, but it is very niche. But I think it comes down to our interactions and our love with the source material that really makes it worthwhile. So I love Jane so much, and I learned a great deal. I got to meet, you know, new people. I was so appreciative of people who were listening and writing in that, you know, it kind of gave me fire to, like, well, I guess I'll, you know, keep going. I'll pick something else and do it. So it's been a lot of fun, and I'm glad I could kind of pave the way for this, because you had mentioned the Hamlet. I'm like, yeah, just do it. Because it seemed like you had your idea. You had taken notes and everything. So it was just, all you had to do is take that leap. So I'm happy to be there. But certainly you can stand on your own and be proud of your own accomplishments.
And I do want to mention Max Romero did do a show called The Dream Factory, which is about novels. So we're not alone. There's other material out there,
yes,
on FW.
Other than the comics and things, yeah.
Let's talk about Shakespeare. Let's talk about Hamlet. That's what we're here for. What is your experience with Shakespeare in general? What does it mean to you?
Sure, yeah. Shakespeare, I think, like every person in the school system, I would assume, I'll just blanket it there, has read Shakespeare. So freshman year, I was reading Romeo and Juliet, and then sophomore year, Julius Caesar, which is one of my favorites, of course. And junior year, I think, was, maybe we didn't do one on junior year. And then senior year, I remember Macbeth, which is another one of my favorites. And then I didn't really touch Shakespeare that much until I dove into my Rory Gilmore's reading list, where there were many more Shakespeare's on there. So I got to read Othello is one of them, and Hamlet was one. So that's kind of where I had my first experience there. And then if the school that I was teaching at put on a Shakespeare play, because it used to alternate every other year with Shakespeare and then a musical, then I would probably read that play before I went into it. And there are other ones that I've seen, stage productions that I wanted to read before I watched. So Hamlet was, I don't know if I could say maybe like 10 or so years ago that I read it, 8 to 10. It was, I think, on the seniors list. So it was pretty easy to go to my colleague who taught 8th grade as well as some 12th grade English, borrow it. And then with that, she gave me several adaptations adaptations, which I know that you will ask me later on what my favorite one is there. So I enjoy Hamlet. I think as I keep reading Hamlet or rereading certain ones that I love a great deal, I get more out of it. I understand the language a bit better. I mean, it is difficult. So the students, I do certainly have empathy for them who struggle with it. And I can understand. The only Hamlet I had to go and get to the library was the No Fear Shakespeare Hamlet. And so I felt a little like cheating because I thought, oh, man, they've got this like plain English on the side. But I thought, you know, that's good for students who are just getting started to give them some help and to sort of build that scaffolding to get them to understand what Shakespeare is. And then as you continue on, I think it gets easier. I don't know, except for scholars, you know, will you ever be able to like speed read through Shakespeare? And there are certainly still phrases in there that I'm like, I have no idea what that means. So let me look it up. But I enjoy him. I think it's good to continue to push ourselves with literature as long as you're a reader to, you know, strive to understand more complex works. Yeah, I think it's just really beautiful. And the majority of things I've read from him, I think are uplifting in the Hamlet way, which means they're not uplifting or happy at all. But I enjoy them. And, you know, just the fact that we've got Antony and Cleopatra or Julius Caesar as I'm a classicist is just great. So that's my history with Shakespeare and Hamlet.
He does have comedies, you know.
He does, yes. Like Twelfth Night, I recently read that with Tom over at the Two True Freaks Internet Radio. And then, you know, I love She's the Man and Midsummer Night's Dream. So I have read those. I just feel like maybe it's me that kind of tends towards these other non-comedies. But yeah, he's a complex fellow, that Shakespeare guy.
I think it's totally valid to start reading it at least with the plain English on the side, or because how are students going to understand the story and then look at the poetry and make those matches? When you're looking at adaptations, when it's theater work, I think that's more understandable because there you got the emotion, you've got the intonations. But when you're just reading through it, scanning it, it can be daunting. It can be, you know, confusing and just not your level of vocabulary. I remember when it switched for me. So there's a moment in university. There was a point where I read Antony and Cleopatra just to understand another text. I wanted to write an essay about Dryden's All for Love, which is really all the events of Act 5 of Antony and Cleopatra. And so I just read the Shakespeare just as, you know, maybe background, maybe there's something in there that I can relate in the essay. So it wasn't like a reading that we had to do. And I realized while I was doing it that, oh, I'm now reading this, looking at footnotes. Of course, you don't understand everything on the first read, but it was just like I was at that point where I read enough literature that I could just read through it and not be consistently trying to translate it, you know. So there's a moment where that's going to unlock for you. Hamlet, do you have favorite adaptations?
I was thinking about this because I remember getting several from my English teacher friend. And I think after that, I just got sick of Hamlet because I had watched so many of them. I feel like it's most likely the Kenneth Branagh version because I remembered his father and I have a fondness for that particular actor. And then Kenneth Branagh, of course. So I think that might be perhaps my number one, though it's been a while since I've watched them. So I kind of feel like, ooh, don't trust me too much. I kept thinking about Ethan Hawke because I thought, wasn't he in an adaptation? But then I looked up the synopsis and I thought, this is probably so weird that I didn't like it very much. And I absolutely, it probably was fine, but I so remember the Mel Gibson, Glenn Close, like scene where he's like on top of her, you know, just like this very kind of Oedipus situation. And I suppose you could read it that way, but it made me very uncomfortable and I didn't like that one at all. So I'm going to say pretty safe that I think it's a 1996 version with Kenneth Branagh, but yeah. I do like Sir Laurence Olivier. That is, I think, a great one as well. And I know there are some like great English actors like to be more contemporary that have played Hamlet. I just haven't seen any of them, unfortunately.
Well, the Branagh is integral. There's nothing missing. And so you get every nuance, you know, even though you've got to sit there for 4 hours or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. But yeah, the whole Oedipus thing, really the originator of that is Freud. Freud wrote about Hamlet and, you know, put his Oedipus take on it. And then a lot of directors decided, yeah, let's do that. And I despise it. I really don't like it. Yeah. So I'm with you there. All right. Well, we want to do a wrap-up of Act 1 mm-hmm. of this play. So I wrote up some big questions. You do that on your show. You know, you get your questions that you ask every episode, basically, about, you know, is it more the, how do you put it?
The spirit of Hamlet or the law of Hamlet. Yeah,
exactly. Those kinds of questions and about each of the characters and, you know, like the stuff that requires interpretation, I guess, would be one way to put it. So I've written up these questions, and if you have others, feel free. I want to take your take on it. Part of this is, well, Denmark, would you prefer it as part of history or an isolated theatrical world? Because depending on the adaptation, sometimes they will excise the whole portion where they talk about the history and the war that's going on and all of this backstory that is in Act 1, it will be removed, making Denmark, Elsinore, just like this isolated nowhere, no time place. And then sometimes they will include it. And then that means you've got a lot of politics going around and maybe it informs the characters. Would you have a preference?
I kind of like that history is, or, you know, this war or history itself is trying to poke itself into the actual play, but it's not necessarily able to puncture it. It reminds me of a novel. Oh, man. I don't know why I keep forgetting this novel about the school-aged kids. A limb of a tree is shaken and the child falls. Do you remember this? Does this sound familiar to you?
Maybe.
It'll come to me. But anyways, just that I'll probably remember what it is. I know that Tom is probably screaming at me right now because we covered it. The separate piece.
There we go.
Yes.
We got to it.
But no, I think that you can almost have it both ways. Like, you have this internal Denmark, all this stuff is going on, but then there are pieces of the outside world trying to poke itself into the play, and I like it that way. It is pretty clean that you can remove it, but does the son return? Because he's fighting the Polish people. Does he come at the very end? I did not make it towards the end.
All the stuff with Fortinbras is the thing. You know, there's like this war with Sweden. And it makes Claudius, I think if you keep it, Claudius, you need to feel at some point that he's a bad king. He thinks he's good, and internally, he's very much a charismatic, and he's convinced everyone around him, or the court anyways. But when Laertes returns and people are banging down the door, then you're feeling, oh, wait, Claudius is cool with the court, but not with the regular people, maybe. And he started to make mistakes. And as far as the war goes, it makes him seem like he's very, we've got a treaty with Sweden and everything's fine. But then you see some Fortinbras making some moves in there. So in other words, Claudius was wrong. Claudius thought he was king of the hill and everything is solved, but he's not good at politics. He's not good at international politics. He's not good at a number of things, including morality. If you remove that, I get it. You know, it's a long play. There's going to be some cuts in most adaptations.
But I do like that Fortinbras, that whole situation, it carries the theme of sort of relationships between fathers and sons wanting to be vindicated or at least seek vengeance for the death of their father.
You know, Laertes, of course, wants to revenge his father the same way that Hamlet does. And then you've got Fortinbras, who is sort of the anti-Hamlet in a way. He's all action. Like, we only see him at the very end. So he's all action, where Hamlet keeps the action at bay. So you always get these sort of mirrorings between all the sons, all the royals in this story. Speaking of royals, Gertrude and Claudius.
Yeah.
How long has this been going on? Like, why did she say yes to this marriage? Was this, in your opinion, an affair that had been going on, or once Hamlet Sr. is dead?
Yeah, it's one of those things where if two people, this is going to be a weird analogy, but it's like happened in kind of the periphery of my friendship circle, or I've known someone who's known someone that's happened. If there is like someone who is of age and suddenly a person who was underage turns 18 and they immediately start dating, like officially dating, you know that they've probably actually been dating before, but it's been hush hush. But only because that person has become legal can they now actually talk about it. So I would say that there has been some hanky-panky between Claudius and Gertrude. I trust in the ghost. I think it comes down to what you think about this apparition that's appearing. But he does seem to have otherworldly knowledge. He talks about purgatory. He has all this stuff. So it seems believable, especially as a classicist. I'm going to tend to believe a spirit that pops up. And the way that he speaks of it when he's talking to Hamlet, it seems like he also knew that Gertrude was with Claudius. But I don't know that necessarily Gertrude knew Claudius's plans to get rid of Hamlet Sr., because she seems aghast when Hamlet accosts her later on in the play about that. But I think it was just like happenstance that, oh, well, my husband's dead, but I'm, I guess, either in love or in lust, depending on how you view it, with Claudius. And then I guess she goes through the formal period of mourning and then just scoops right up, which it's not the first time we've heard about that in history anyways, of someone waiting until the proper mourning period ends and then marry somebody. So
yeah.
So I think it's been going on for a while. I don't think she had anything to do with the actual plan of fratricide. But yeah, no, she's not very Lady Macbethish, I would say.
No, she's not a murderer. I wouldn't believe that. But there is a reading of the play that is more political, where as queen, suddenly she's without a king. Okay, time to remarry very quickly, because this is how regimes fall. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to create some stability right away. But at the same time, it's like, well, Hamlet was supposed to be king, so what gives here? So, you know, but you put a lot of trust in that ghost.
I do.
More than Hamlet does.
More than Hamlet does?
Hamlet is, at first, well, for a long time, I think one of the reasons that he delays his plans, depending on the reading, of course, is that, is this really my father's spirit, or is this a demon trying to lure me into sin?
Yeah, and he does, which I appreciate, that he wants verification of the facts before he actually decides upon his venture to kill Claudius.
The ghost is not presented as necessarily trustworthy. What is his nature? You know, well, so as a classicist, for you, this is a spirit. There's an actual ghost there. It's not Hamlet's madness.
Yes, and given Shakespeare's penchant, I think, for writing some, you know, spirits and ghosts and things into his work, yes, I believe that there's an actual ghost there. Plus, okay, it's not just Hamlet seeing it.
No, it's true. I mean, this is a problem of the play, is that Hamlet is the only one hearing him. You know, like, other people see it, only Hamlet hears it. So there's a middle ground there where if people want to imagine that Hamlet, it's all part of his diseased mind, that he puts himself on this revenge mission, then maybe the ghost is partly in his head. But it's hard to, I mean, the ghost tells him things that turn out to be true. So, okay, you know, at some point, directors that want to turn this into a madness story, or a pure madness story, mm-hmm, where the ghost isn't real, they've got to make cuts that aren't true to the text.
Right.
Does Hamlet go mad, or does he feign madness? This is a big question.
This is
not just act one, but in act one is the moment where he tells his friends, look, I'm going to be a little bit Looney Tunes here.
Yes, I was going to point to that, yeah.
Yeah, but then he is. So where do you follow this?
Yeah, you can ask this every act, every scene, for sure. And even as I was reading through, I'm like, oh my gosh, he says that he's pretending. Now it's like, no, he's not pretending. My question is, what would his motivation be, or what would he get out of it for being mad? Because I think about people who pretend to be something they're not in classical history. It's hard to be a nerd. So I'll just keep it simple this time and say Odysseus, who pretended to be mad when Agamemnon came to Ithaca to try to get him to join his army. And he was just pretending to be insane the entire time so that he wouldn't be brought into the army. And then the only thing that stopped him, because he was plowing the fields, is that they picked up young Telemachus, who was a baby at the time, and put him right in front of his plow because he was going to run over him. And so Odysseus had to drop the act. That, what he was getting out of that, obviously, was trying to stay out of the whole Trojan War situation. So what is Hamlet getting out of this, pretending to be mad? I think I would say that yes and no. Is he mad? Like, is this legitimate or not? I think that there was a break from, you know, his father. I think that there is a close relationship, even though we don't get to see it very much. We just see it or hear about it in these speeches and how he acts. I think having that death and having his mother get over that mourning period so quickly and marry his uncle. That's a big thing. The ghost, I think, breaks through something, because after that, Hamlet really rails against the female sex. Not only Gertrude and her betrayal, he goes off on Ophelia, which we, of course, know the bad end of what happens there. I think it's grief, too, that, you know, legitimately is hard for him to deal with. On the side of him pretending, I think him pretending to be mad gives him the opportunity to put on a show and not be kind of mournful or be suspicious. So if he's just like being crazy, they're wondering why he's crazy or what's caused this. But nobody's wondering whether he is trying to figure out if his uncle killed his father, and then what is he going to do next? So that, like, I think he's able to sort of push suspicions to some other angle by pretending to be crazy, and they'll just worry about him, but not see him sneaking around corridors and wondering what's going on. So that's kind of my thinking. I think there is some craziness in there. I think it kind of goes back and forth. We've seen in certain things, like I read Papillon this summer, and he pretends to be mad for a certain period of time. And I think in doing that, you do legitimately fall into a madness as well. And it's hard to snap yourself out of it, which is, I think, what we see with Hamlet as this progresses. But it's almost like very hammed up, the things that he's doing, that it's just like bonkers, and everyone, you kind of wonder, like, is this actually, should this be a comedy with some of the things that he's saying? But he's also wise in some of this stuff, like his interactions with Polonius. He's saying crazy things, but they're also insightful. It's crazy. So I would say yes and no, but I think at this particular part of the play, just looking at Act One, I think he very much is pretending. He is pretending. So I think the deeper question is just, what is his motivation, or what does he get out of pretending to be mad? So those are my thoughts.
Yeah, interesting that you mentioned Papillon, because, you know, Denmark is a prison. So there's the idea of being trapped in a situation. The only recourse is perhaps to, in this crazy world, let me be crazy and then shake a few trees, so to speak, you know. I think you're exactly right. He takes off from, okay, I've been melancholy, which is to say, in the throes of a depression, for a while now. Everybody's noticed that. What if now I'm manic? They'll believe anything. They'll believe this is just, and then I don't have to go back to university, and I can stick around, and nobody's going to be suspicious of my actions necessarily. But of course, in doing so, he creates a lot of tragedy. And then maybe you could say, oh, he's going to fall into a madness, like his mad rage that he gets later, where he kills someone, where he almost violates his mother, according to Freud. So all of this stuff, by the end, it's like, well, now, you know, maybe he's becoming someone else. Maybe he's falling into madness.
Mm-hmm.
And the last question I had on my sheet here is, maybe this isn't truly answerable from Act One, but Polonius at this point, foolish or sinister? Because this is a question that, like, most people think Polonius is quite foolish, a doddering old man. He always gets it wrong. But in the complete play, he's a little more sinister. Like, you can see him as, I mean, politically, he got himself to the right-hand man position of this new regime. So he's got to have a bit of skill there. And is he controlling of Laertes and Ophelia? Mm. So do you see him as more of a foolish figure, or is he like the side villain?
I think between those two, because those are, completely different. I would say that he's probably more foolish. Just with his interactions, man, Ophelia is such she's my least liked female in Shakespeare, I have to say. But I do feel bad for her. In his talking to her, because you said the word controlling, part of it is for his honor, because I think he brings that up when he's speaking to her, as well as Laertes, saying, like, think not of yourself, but also of my honor, because of course it reflects back on him. But he is worried about her, but he does say that she's kind of not as good as Hamlet, so she's got to watch out. Yeah, I think he has, like, best interests in mind as much as a man can for his daughter in a very patriarchal society and time period and everything. Yeah, he keeps saying, you know, I'll stick to the point. And then you have this huge monologue that he does not stick to the point. So he does seem foolish. I think he has good intentions, maybe not go about it the right way, potentially. He does let his son go to France, right? So that would be like, I think he's just contradictory, because that's kind of what I'm coming to, because he lets him go, but then he also sends...
Yes, a spy who,
yes,
who shows up at the,
like,
top of Act Two, yeah.
Yes, and tries to, I know we're pushing on to that, but, you know, tries to basically, like, catch his son by looking for kind of people who are maybe not doing the best kind of stuff. So I lean towards foolish and not villainy, because what would his purpose be in, he can't really get rid of Hamlet, because I know he's trying to prove his madness to everybody there, but I don't know what benefits he would get out of that. Though at one point, isn't Laertes potentially in line for the throne? Like, he could be.
There's something, yeah, there's a line of dialogue in there. I don't know. Because the way Claudius treats Laertes, it's very much like, this is the son I wish I had had. Instead of this, obviously it's adopted because it's his nephew, but instead of Hamlet, who's really a pain in the ass. He's so warm towards Laertes, and he gives him permission to go to France, etc. Whereas with Hamlet, the expectations aren't the same, obviously, you know. You know, maybe, just like Ophelia's not good enough for Hamlet, towards the end, after she's dead, Gertrude says, you know, I had in mind that she'd be a great wife for Hamlet or something. So, which is it? You know, so there's a lot of people thinking things, but those things aren't true, especially Polonius. Polonius always gets it wrong. You know, he's wrong about everything in the play, including backing the wrong horse, which I think is that villainy. Now, he's not the villain, but he certainly falls in line behind the villain. He doesn't know about the murder, but at the same time, you know, was he prime minister to Hamlet Sr. and then just keeps the role with Claudius? That doesn't feel right. I don't know. So, but also we don't learn about any other political character that was in the previous regime. It's not always clear. So very often it's based on performance. And a lot of performers do it as a foolish old man. When somebody puts a little bit of darkness in it, I really like it. I feel like that gives the character more dimension. Every time we're going to do a wrap-up, I'm going to have a different guest, obviously, and we're going to look at another Hamlet adaptation, or in this case, I don't know if we want to call it an adaptation exactly, an inspiration, but we want to talk a little bit about The Lion King from 1994, the Disney classic, one of the great Disney movies of the modern era, if not all eras. Is The Lion King, you know, a film that you do affect?
No, I do. I do like it, yes. I mean, I burst into tears when the poster died. I was like, well... Once a crier during the scene, always a crier, I guess.
But is it Hamlet? I guess that's the question. Because
Is it Hamlet? I don't think so.
You don't? Okay. Because there are elements that they have in common. And the makers of The Lion King originally were looking at different sources. Actually, it was supposed to be Bambi in Africa. That's what they were making. But then, because it was an original piece, they wanted to hang a little more classic literature onto it. And when they noticed a prince whose father is killed, okay, and then what if we make the killer the uncle? So suddenly we got some Hamlet-isms in there. It's very thin, but that was like the main piece of it. And so now I'm looking at The Lion King with the Hamlet filter. And trying to see where other, because they tried to put, knowing that that's what they were doing, they tried to put other little bits in there. Obviously, Mufasa shows up as a ghost who tells Simba, not go avenge me, it's like, remember who you are, right? So it sends Simba back to Pride Rock and so on. So did you notice any other similarities?
Yeah, certainly the theme of fathers and sons, I think, is big. Ophelia, luckily, does not go the way of Ophelia. I'm happy for that. I think you have almost a Rosencrantz, Guildenstern in Timon and Pumbaa.
Almost,
a little bit there.
A bit reversed.
Yes.
I mean, they're the same kind of party boys that they are in the play. And I say that because, like, in the modern adaptations, whenever they do, like, a modern take, those guys are always, like, they're frat boys.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, they're not going to betray Simba. You know, it's like the happy, yes, there's a lot of death, But it's kind of the happy version of Hamlet where he's not betrayed by all his friends and not all his loved ones die. One of the things that I was looking at reviews of the film from friends on Letterboxd. And I have a good friend who did not care for The Lion King much. He saw it late in life and said something to the effect that he thought it was kind of choppy and this is the big classic was kind of his reaction. But one of the things that he brought up, I think, is actually a strength and has actually a Shakespeareanism. Well, the body politic, basically. Once Scar is in control of Pride Rock, yes, he gives it over to the hyenas, but there's a drought. And even the hyenas are starving. How can this be Scar's fault? How do we know he's a bad king if it's really a random environmental element that destroys the kingdom? But I would say this is very much Shakespeare. When the king, the head of the state, is a bad person in Shakespeare, bad things happen. So when Claudius is king, suddenly the kingdom is diseased. You know, whatever descriptions that Hamlet gives, it's often through Hamlet. Hamlet gives it descriptions like it is a diseased state, an unweeded garden. And well, there are ghosts walking around suddenly and there's war brewing and there's all of these bad things happen because the king is a usurper, you know, is not supposed to be the king. Whereas when we get, like in Act One, we get descriptions of the murder and Hamlet Sr. is sleeping in his garden. Like, what is this garden in Elsinore? Because when you look at the movies, it's a frozen wasteland. You know, it's a cold castle. It's never a beautiful garden somewhere. There's none of that because you have a king who is the wrongful heir. And so everything's going to go to seed. And I think that's what happens with Scar in the movie.
No, that's, yeah, absolutely a good thought.
I'm looking at it as well. Of course, another element is that the exile, you know, the uncle contrives to exile the prince, and then he returns, but it happens at a different point in the story, obviously. But when I'm looking at this, like, what can we learn from this about the play, which isn't easy because the similarities are thin, as we've said. One of the things that really struck me is the message of the ghost. In the play, you've got the ghost saying, "Remember me, remember me." And and he comes back later and says, "You've forgotten your mission and you've forgotten your revenge. You know, get back on track, leave your mom alone. You go after the real bad guy." So there is a question of remembering, and the ghost is there to make you remember. And in this, he doesn't say, "Remember me." He says, "Remember who you are." And that's a crucial difference, evokes the question of why Hamlet let this happen. Why didn't he become king? If he's the heir, why is he not king? Why did he let this happen? You've forgotten your father? Have you forgotten what happened to him and your revenge, etc.? Or deeper yet, have you forgotten who you are? That you are the rightful king. Start acting like it. Start being decisive. Start being an actor. But the whole remembrance theme that the ghost brings in The Lion King puts a twist on it that makes me think, oh yeah, I mean, there's like a deeper meaning to remember me, because remember me, remember the king, remember your father. I am my father's son. I am the new king, or I should have been the new king. So my father is me in this context. Or, I mean, there's at least that mirror there.
So I think it also brings up a question then, in terms of like virtues and mores, and this calls, of course, into question who this ghost would be. And of course, I've said that I believe it is real and it's actually Hamlet Sr. But the fact that he is perpetuating or asking his son to perpetuate violence is very interesting, because we've already had fratricide committed, which I think a member, someone says in this play that it is like a biblical murder there. I also think Romulus and Remus, of course. But then now you're asking for more violence within the family to occur. And I don't know sort of what the virtues would be, you know, around that time or in that particular place. But even just thinking about William Shakespeare's time, how do you do that? Would there have been a better way? Did the vengeance actually mean a life for a life, or could something else have been done? So I was just thinking about that as you were talking. But no, it is very beautiful. In the essence of Hamlet Sr. is actually in Hamlet Jr., if you think about it that way. But also, yeah, don't forget who you in essence are as well. So perhaps calling upon those virtues and mores. So yeah, there's certainly something I think to get from that.
Well, I think the whole thing in The Lion King that kind of shares some DNA with with Hamlet is that theme of the circle of life that they set up at the beginning. The circle of life isn't just we eat certain animals and when we die, become grass and, you know, like all of this. Right. But really, that cycle is also inheritance. Mufasa will give his role over to Simba, who will give it over to his child. And that is interrupted by Scar, by Claudius. And now that inheritance doesn't go. And so everything is out of whack. It creates chaos. In The Lion King, the hyenas are sort of a death cult. You know, they live among the bones and they are not part of the cycle of life, which you'd think normally, yes, they would be. They mm-hmm. eat the carrion, you know, they pick up the scraps, but that's part of the cycle. In The Lion King, they are not part of the cycle of life. They are outside of it and they're painted as death worshippers. They only eat the dead. You know, there's something wrong about that in the movie anyways, in the way that it's presented. At least I feel like that's the case. And in Hamlet, we can't talk about a death cult, but the fact that Claudius has interrupted the cycle by taking over the inheritance that was Hamlet's by right, has usurped the kingdom, has usurped his brother's wife, that creates upheaval of all sorts. You know, it's gonna lead to greater and greater tragedy, obviously, in terms of the drama. But even the world seems creepier as a result. You're just walking around and people are digging up graves, you know, it's that kind of world suddenly. But I don't think Denmark was like that before or would have been after. So in terms of the two movies, that's to me a thematic similarity. I read some trivia there that an earlier alternate ending that absolutely no one would have enjoyed, Scar winds up killing Simba as he also dies. You know, he burns in a fire or something, but Simba is killed to make it closer to Hamlet. So there's an original storyboard where Scar even says a line from Shakespeare play. Like, he's the one that says, "Good night, sweet prince." Yeah. Usurps Horatio's line there. Nobody's childhoods were ruined. It's not in the final version. But you can see where they tried to at least make it more like Hamlet. But can you make Hamlet for kids?
Yeah, this is close. And apparently test audiences were sobbing over Mufasa's original. Apparently it was like even worse.
Oh yeah, was it?
And so they toned it down. And it's still bad. I still break out into tears.
It's a surprisingly violent film. Yeah. Surprisingly sexual as well. I feel like there's, you know, the romance between the lions or just...
Oh, yeah.
Frankish talk about having to marry your best friend. And, you know, she's Ophelia, but she's Horatio at the same time. You know, there's a lot of these combinations in there. Mm-hmm. It's surprisingly adult, but I feel like in the 90s, Disney was kind of doing that. And like Hunchback of Notre Dame is also kind of like that, you know, hellish. And yeah. Right. So they were pushing the envelope a little bit more mm-hmm. than they had before or since. I don't know about since, but certainly. So yeah. So The Lion King, not an adaptation. I think we can agree.
Yeah. Maybe the spirit of it. I think, you know, if I were to go back to that previous question mm-hmm. you had about maybe what have you learned more about Hamlet from or through the lens of The Lion King, I think that relationship between Hamlet Sr. and Hamlet Jr. would be something that might be highlighted because you don't really understand it too much. I think I had already said maybe through his reactions to seeing the ghost and what he plans on doing, maybe his mournful behavior and things like that, or how other people speak of Hamlet Sr. But in watching The Lion King and seeing that beautiful relationship between Simba and Mufasa and actually watching that death, then you can kind of pull that over to Hamlet and imagine, well, these two may have been actually really close. Father and son really loved each other. And so that death really hit Hamlet hard, Hamlet Jr. So that might be something that I pull over because you lose that emotional impact. There are a lot of emotions in this play, but that might not necessarily be something that you experience. You see it later with Polonius and Laertes. You kind of start to see that, and now you witness that death, and now you see the direct result and direct emotional impact of it on the son. But we didn't get that at the beginning of the play.
And on Ophelia as well. She goes mad because of this. Yeah. You're completely right. The fact that we don't get a real sense of the relationship, of the father-son relationship in the play, always makes me question. People will hear me do it over a number of episodes, but I've always questioned what this relationship actually was. It's like, is there an element of hero worship? Because all we know about Senior, obviously Hamlet loves him or thought he was the bee's knees, but he was always at the wars. He was gone to the wars. And they keep saying stuff like that. Oh, this was the year, you know, Hamlet was a little boy born. Hamlet Senior went to the wars. And it feels like he's never there, which allows for that affair to blossom between Gertrude and Claudius, perhaps. He's an absent husband. If he's an absent father, then Hamlet, what's with you? You know, did you really care about this man? Or did you care about this man, but he never cared about you? And the way the ghost is very harsh with him, was that the relationship? You know, because we don't get that foreground, the actual father-son relationship, whether positive or negative, we just don't know in the text. It makes me question that relationship, if it existed mm-hmm. at all. If Hamlet mm-hmm. isn't just putting someone on a pedestal, but in reality, you never knew your father, really, but you just idealized him. Mm-hmm. If we had that foreground like we do in Lion King, it changes everything. And I feel like, yeah, it changes the emotion throughout. That's a very interesting observation. Well, on that, let's talk about Dear Reader a little bit. No, but we just had the, like last month, we just got a promo for it for the new season.
Yep.
Of course, it's not going to be about Jane Eyre. So
it's not.
What is it going to be about?
It's going to be about a 1936 play called The Women by Clare Booth Luce. And this was something that I read last year, and the entire play is just women. And it is really quick as in like the dialogue is super speedy, like Gilmore Girls, basically the pre-Gilmore Girls. And it's just like really complicated female relationships. There's adultery. You kind of have this one woman who's almost like the head of the queen bee of the pack or so. Her husband find out that he's been having an affair. And then, well, how do her friends deal with that? Did they tell her? Did they go and investigate more and like want to learn more? Are these women being supportive of one another? Or are they just trying to claw each other to the top? It's very interesting, like female dynamics, especially in the 30s, you know, what wave of feminism would that have been? Maybe the first or second. Oh, the first, I guess. So thinking about that. And then there are three cinematic adaptations. One was 1939 with an amazing cast. I can't wait to talk about that one. And that is almost verbatim from the play, which is great. And that is super quick. And then there's a 56 one that I've actually never seen called The Opposite Sex. And then there's a 2008 one, which is the most recent. And that'll be interesting to talk about in terms of like, how did you contemporize some of these relationships or the things that have been going on and transition that to more modern times as Meg Ryan starring in it.
Oh.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to doing this deep diving. It's always interesting finding journals and academic articles on things. I haven't started doing my research yet, but it's always fun to read people's writings on this and get more depth and insight into the work and then look at these films. So for the first time, I mean, it's only season two, but yeah, this will only be looking at film adaptations, whereas Jane Eyre went all over the place because of course it's so well known that it had so many adaptations.
There's no The Women manga.
Not as far as I know. This is as much as I have. I'm hopeful. I actually found the writer-director of the 2008 version on Instagram, and so I DM'd her. But when you're not friends with someone, it's hard because they just, like, those DMs just go someplace random, and who are you? You know, it's just, I mean, when I get those, I'm just like, delete. I'll look at what the subject line is, but then go. So I did put, like, RE, The Women 2008, and then like asked her if she wanted to be on, but she hasn't responded. I'll probably try again, but that would be amazing to talk to the actual person who put that into play. Like, how did you translate, you know, something from 1936 all the way to 2008? But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And it is like a left turn. I think I went even more niche from Jane Eyre to a play that probably not many people have ever heard of before. But I thought this would be a quick one because Jane Eyre, you'll probably find this soon, sir. But after 10 episodes of the same thing and like deep diving into it, I started to like confuse facts. Like, did this happen in the original? I'm not sure.
Right.
And then it just kind of your time. You want to be careful to not run out on your love of it, because if you're doing too much or you're looking at too many things that are bad adaptations, then it's just going to ruin your your love of the original. So I'm like, oh, this will be a 4-episode season. It'll be great.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have that same problem in the sense that I've been reading Hamlet consistently, reading or watching Hamlet consistently for decades. So that's not a big problem. But also, it's a you'll find this maybe to be true, even with your smaller sample. A play is meant to be played. You can read it, obviously, and some critics think the text can never be equaled by performance or adaptation. Sure, because choices have to be made. And while it's all in text form, every choice is possible within that line, within that text. So once they make choices, well, then you're criticizing the choices rather than everything that the line contains. So that's one thing. But it means also that you can just watch these things and like the interpretations, like, I mean, it's meant to be seen rather than read in design. So I think that takes some of the edge off, you know. And as long as the Branna exists, and I always start with that one when I speak about a piece of Hamlet, that one is complete. So they may change inflection or make choices, but it's the whole text. So as long as I look at that one first, I'm always going to know, okay, that's in the play. As opposed to not, you know.
Did he direct that
yes.
one too?
Yes.
Okay.
It's part of his great trilogy for me, you know, Henry V, Much Ado About Nothing, and this one.
Not Othello.
Othello, he plays in it, but did not direct it.
Oh, okay.
He's great as Iago in that.
Oh, my goodness.
Iago is one of my favorite characters. That's my season two.
Although
my season two will be Act Two, which I'll get to. You know, next, basically, it's about 9 episodes per act.
Whoa.
Scene by scene. It's a completely different take on, I don't think I could do what you did, which is to, you know, look at an entire adaptation for a whole episode. Mm-hmm. It's too big. It's too big for me. It was just, just the way that I think about the play. I just can do. Also, you're much better at doing research than I am. So, you know, you're a researcher, whereas I kind of speak off the cuff. It's all opinion. Sure. It's all my own, which is kind of how I coasted through university.
Whoa.
It's true. So, Stella, thank you so much for doing this with me today. We talked about where you're going next, so we can't wait for those episodes to drop. I'll let you slip back to the library, and I'll play a promo. And when I return, I'll address some of the feedback the show's gotten. Stick around.
Why, you little... Did you know about this?
I was told you were clever. You must be. To keep Stephen from seeing how cheap you are.
13 years of sex with the same man can be a little bit boring.
'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know it used to be mad love. So take a look what you've done. 'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. Hey!
Dear Reader, Season 2. Join me, Stella, as I look at the 1936 play The Women by Clare Boothe Luce and its 3 cinematic adaptations from 1939, 1956, and 2008. Does the play highlight the complicated aspects of female friendship or display the cattiness of women when in competition with each other and with time? Listen and find out. Coming soon to the Fire and Water Podcasting Network.
L'amour. That's French for love.
Let's open that mailbag and read a few missives. Rob McCarthy thanks the network for adding this show because he's using the discussions to make the guy who helps him out of bed believe Rob has a degree. Those sound like pretty intense out-of-bed conversations. Rob also thinks Tom Mandrake's Hamlet looks like Jimmy Page and reveals his final paper at uni was about showing why Hamlet's revenge could not work because he was painted as Christian, and vengeance is the Lord's purview according to the Bible. On that question of religion, Alan W. Wright says, I know there's a theory out there that Shakespeare was a secret Catholic. In my mind, it has a 52% chance of being true, which, while by no means a certainty, is still 51% more than I think about the secret Earl theory, beloved by so many actors who are brilliant on stage like Mark Rylance. To me, the thing that makes Shakespeare as a Catholic ever so slightly more likely than not is the character of Hamlet. Yes, Alan, Jacoby also believes this Earl theory. I can't fathom it. Anyway, I'm keeping my comments for that when theater is addressed itself in the play. Stay tuned. More comments from Alan. He says, I love looking at the different Hamlets, and like you, Olivier falls further down on my lists of Hamlets. Perhaps the first season opening song of Slings and Arrows was being sung to Olivier's version. Yeah, it sure was, Alan. And speaking of Slings and Arrows, if Hyperion to a Satyr gets a spin-off, surely a show about Slings and Arrows would be a natural. And of course, you could also do a podcast on how Branna, being informed by John Barton, etc., knows how to deliver Shakespearean lines with perfect mood, but also perfect clarity, making it fresh and understandable to modern audiences while not seeming gimmicky. Familiar, but by no means vulgar. He's also started watching Slings and Arrows again and says, since you talk about the reality of old Hamlet's ghost, how real do you think Oliver's ghost is in Slings and Arrows? Genuine visit from the beyond? A product of Jeffrey's madness? Or a creative process? Or a mixture of both? The first time we see Oliver's ghost, Jeffrey isn't there, and it's like the two morticians are serving as the guards in the play to confirm the ghost's independent reality. Yes, I think Oliver has scenes with other people or with other people around where Jeffrey isn't. Just like the play it's based on, there's an ambiguity, but also not quite an ambiguity. Captain Entropy says, Siskoid, this is a lot more work than listening to you talk about Marvel 2-in-1. Furthermore, I doubt any staging you're referencing uses the line, Milady, tis the clobbering hour. That said, I am learning a lot. I don't have a great background in Hamlet. I read the play in school and watched a live performance on a field trip. We had a terrifically good English teacher. She was also our French teacher, which in retrospect was very Canadian of her. Nevertheless, I don't think that at 17, I got 10% out of the play of what I was supposed to get. Now I'm listening to you talk about the myriads of themes and metaphors Shakespeare as author puts into the play, or alternately, a director can draw out of this play, whether the author thought of them or not. I'm flabbergasted. It's no wonder this is such a passion project for you. At first, as I listened, I was surprised at how many scenes and lines people would cut in staging. Now I think I understand that the director has to pick and choose what he's going to communicate with each scene. You can't keep every line or every possible line reading any more than you can go into a Greek diner and order everything on the novella-sized menu. So Hamlet, like Batman, is endlessly malleable. Something about dead parents in there. Is the lesson that it's amazing what a storyteller can do when he starts with family trauma? Probably not. That seems too small. I guess I'll have to keep listening. Captain Entropy, I think you can offer an integral version of the play. Branna proved that. But it means it's going to be extra long, on stage especially. The ancillary characters only really live with the full text, in my opinion, but the focus may be somewhere else, depending on the direction. And also, like you said, you can't have every line reading, every interpretation within the same adaptation. That's just impossible. Brian Linton says, Siskoid, thank you for putting this show together. I've been looking forward to it since you teased it in the comments for Stella's Dear Reader show. I enjoy Shakespeare, but admit that I struggle with the text. I count myself lucky when I can follow the basic plot and identify all the characters. Unfortunately, the subtle wordplay and deeper symbolism of the text is often lost on me. As a result, I'm enjoying learning about all of that in this show. I have seen three of the film versions of Hamlet that you're covering, Branagh's, Gibson's, and Tennant's. Of the three, I probably prefer Branagh's version, but I'm a sucker for any of his Shakespeare productions. Branagh's Henry V is in my top 10 list of favorite movies. I have not seen Derek Jacobi's rendition of Hamlet, but as a fan of his, I now feel the need to track it down. All that to say that I really like the comparisons you make between the different adaptations. And then we have Ange, who says, this is a great show with so much detail and passion put into it. You can't help but be swept up. I've read the play many times and seen many of the incarnations you reference, but I haven't boiled it down to things like, where is Hamlet sitting when the scene starts and how does that impact the dialogue? Incredible. I am thoroughly impressed. I don't know how often I'll comment because there will most likely be variants of this is awesome, but know that I'm listening. But he did keep commenting. He says, somewhere along the way, I imprinted that Polonius is a buffoon and that unfortunately has impacted the way I see the character every time. So it is interesting to hear your take on his speech and the degrees of character here. Stupid, nefarious, or self-contradictory. Now, I wonder how many people in our generation, started with the Zeffirelli version as the first one we saw, because, 1990 makes kind of sense. It was my first one, staged. And that in that one, a lot of the characters are boiled down to maybe a sort of two-dimensional version. And certainly Polonius suffers from that, despite being played by the great Ian Holm. Maybe that's where you got it, Ange. I don't know. You tell me. Another preformed opinion of his. My take is Hamlet is quite sane and starts out thinking he's going to feign madness, only to then actually descend into insanity. So again, I love the breakdown of performances, pointing out subtleties which might hint that the madness is already there. In particular, learning that Olivier did the voice of the ghost in the film. A nice deep cut, questioning the sanity of the prince. And the rock opera, just saying outright he is mad at this point, is a gutsy call. And, well, that ends our look at Act 1. Thanks again to my guest Stella, and I hope you'll follow her to Dear Reader. Next time, we take our first bite out of Act 2, with its first scene, and hey, it's the one I keep talking about where Polonius is really sinister. And with Cheers Cast returning for its sixth season, I've relinquished the Thursday slot back to Ryan Daly, but I won't wait for the show's next hiatus. You can expect Hyperion to a Satyr to get a monthly slot on some random Friday, probably. We're going to go a bit slower for a while, give you more time to digest, maybe. So hey, if you have thoughts on this particular episode, of course, head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com and put keyboard to digital paper. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FWpodcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you, dear listener, will return for Act 2, Scene 1.